and welcome to a special episode of Spectator Sounds. I'm Kate Andrews. The government has set out a phased removal of petrol and diesel cars to usher in a new age of electric vehicles. Sales of the former will be banned from 2030. To what extent will electric cars help improve the environment and reduce our carbon footprint? Is the infrastructure in place to manage this transition? And is the consumer demand there? Joining me today to discuss all this and more are Mike Hawes, CEO of the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, and Chris O'Shea, the CEO of Centrica. This podcast is kindly sponsored by Centrica. I'll start with the Transport Secretary. Last November, the UK announced the end of petrol and diesel car sales by 2030. Hybrids get an extension until 2035. This was a decision clearly made to move towards electric vehicles. It's something you've been an advocate of for a long time. What do you see as the benefits of this move?
Well, I drive an electric vehicle, so I kind of know the benefits straight off the bat. They're delightful to drive, but it is a slightly different mentality. I describe it more as like having a mobile phone. You'd never leave your house without your mobile phone fully charged for the day. And you kind of need to think about an electric vehicle in similar terms. You kind of want to get it charged primarily overnight and then be able to sort of set off. And a lot of times people say, and this is probably slightly more sort of kind of theoretical part of the discussion, but a lot of times people say, aren't you worried about sort of running out of power? And I point out to them, like, do you live in a petrol station? And they'll look at me like, no, of course I don't live in a petrol station. I say, well, I basically do with an electric car. It's like I live in a charging station because I can charge it up overnight and drive it off. So why should I feel any anxiety about it? So there is a difference in approach. And I carried all of that with me to the decision that we made last year on ending the sale of petrol and diesel by 2030, because we all know it's going to happen anyway. We've been discussing it for years. We know that there will be some advantages as well as some challenges in being the first movers in this. But by being the first country in the world to have legislated for zero carbon by 2050, it seemed to me to be fitting to also be the first major economy to legislate for 2030 to end the sale of petrol and diesel, and 2035 for the end of the low carbon hybrids. So that was sort of what was going through my mind, if you want to know, and the logic behind the decision.
Mike, did you welcome the decision?
Yeah, as Grant said, I think we saw this coming. The industry's been moving towards this for many years. And, you know, you look at the vehicles that are now being launched for this year. I mean, this year alone, there'll be more electric vehicles, new launches, than either petrol or diesel. And this was decisions that were taken some 5-10 years ago from the industry, because that's the development time. So at least we now have the certainty about when this end of sale date will be. 2030 is a real challenge. I think the additional 5 years to allow for hybrids to continue to be sold was critically important for the industry, because, you know, we've got to turn an entire market around, a market that's been based on petrol and diesel for over 100 years. To do that, the industry's got to supply the products, but the consumer's got to make that transition. There are a lot of issues around that which we still need to address. But fundamentally, you know, if the industry's been investing billions in these new technologies, you need to see a return on that investment. And that means increasing the sales as rapidly as possible. Last year, about 1 in 10 cars plugged in. So we've got to go from 1 in 10 to 10 out of 10 in 9 years. And that's the scale of the challenge. So having a degree of certainty is important. What we now need to see now is basically the alignment of all the different issues that will help the consumer, the customer, make that transition.
Well, let's jump into some of those challenges. Chris, Mike's Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders suggests that to make this move for electric vehicles, the UK will need to build more than 1.9 million public charging points by 2030. This would mean over 500 built per day. Scottish Power actually suggested we might need 4,000 built a day. I mean, even on the conservative end, is this really feasible?
I think you'd be amazed at what people can achieve when they put their minds to it. And so whilst it sounds like a huge challenge right now, I think we can find a way to achieve that. I think it's really important, though, that we make sure that we have public charging networks. I think we have to be quite careful that if we have lots of companies that have proprietary charging networks, then what we'll see is networks that are rolled out to potentially more affluent areas where people at the moment can afford electric vehicles, rather than if we all pool our resources to having a public infrastructure, which has open source, then we can, if we do that, then we can see something across the country, and we can use this also as part of the leveling up agenda.
Grant, Chris is very much invoking the spirit of where there's a will, there's a way. But let's say it is feasible. Is it totally desirable? Is this really going to be the game changer when it comes to tackling global warming? If you compare certain electric vehicles to traditional vehicles, say the Tesla Model S, which will emit about 44 tons of CO2, that's only roughly 5 tons less than a similar Audi A7.
No, every single study I've seen of this has been completely misleading. For example, they make assumptions like the energy going into the car to drive it is not entirely clean. Yeah, of course, if you don't clean up your grid, you can come up with some very unfavorable comparisons. But once you clean up the grid, the comparisons are always much, much better. And of course, you do need to think about how you produce the car, how you dig for the minerals required for the battery and all the rest of it. But I can't tell you how many times people have come to me and said, you know, Secretary of State, this is not as green as you think it is. And I go back to the scientists, to my chief scientific advisor, to officials, and I go round the circle again. And every single time, the surveys that say this are dodgy. And they're dodgy because they typically assume that some of the power going into the car is not produced through green energy. But, you know, as Chris will tell you, the grid is very, very quickly greening up. Who would have thought? I mean, by the way, I was in the cabinet 8 years ago, I guess it was, when we were having these conversations about wind power and the extent to which we would have to support the market in order to, well, as we all know, the history of that has been extraordinary. I mean, we produce enormous amounts of power through wind now. There's no sign of that slowing down, and we're not having to support the market to do it. So we're able to create more of that energy in a green way. As long as you do that, then I think it is a not just a minor, but a major contribution. Let me put some figures on it. So if you think now that the transport is probably accountable for about 30% of greenhouse gases, it used to be energy. It used to be Chris's fault. Now it's my fault, you know. And when you have transport responsible for that amount, you have to have a look where in transport. And people think it's going to be planes or ships or something. Actually, 90% of the carbon is coming from road transport in various different forms. And of that, the biggest chunk by a long way is cars. And we've already got the technology to deal with it. This is not one of these areas where we have to wait for the technology to be invented. You know, it's a bit trickier with HGVs, though I'm going to be saying more about that in the green paper quite soon. But with cars, the solution's already here. Although, as Mike would rightly point out, we need to carry on investing in the technology to make sure that we can make the transition. And we're doing that in a big way with a lot of money going into that kind of research. But basically, it's there. Long answer to a simple question. I just don't buy the idea that it isn't substantially better not to be pumping out CO2 at the tailpipe. I think we're definitely on the right track.
So to follow up, Grant, it was the World Economic Forum that suggested that it takes 9 years for an electric car to be greener than a diesel car, in part because the creation of the car requires almost 60% more CO2 than their gas-guzzling counterparts. Amnesty International has raised serious red flags about rare materials being sourced and the way that they're sourced. It can often involve slave labor. I mean, we're not totally going to dismiss these kinds of studies, are we? It may be the case that the weight falls towards the benefits of electric cars, but there's still quite a lot of hurdles to overcome in a very short period of time.
Sure. Is it the case that you mustn't use slave labor if you're going to make it work? Yes. You know, do you need to put clean energy in to get clean tailpipe exit? Yes. Do you need to think about how you make the car and the energy that's being used to make it? Yes. But sure, there are challenges. But none of these things are insurmountable. And I'm afraid too often these arguments are just being used by people who would prefer us not to be making this very, very necessary transition.
Well, Mike, what are your thoughts on these ethical concerns? And we have to do something with a lot of the low-hanging fruit already been picked. It's time to move on to these difficult, possibly more expensive decisions, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, first of all, moving from internal combustion engines, which, you know, have evolved in terms of their efficiency and deliver the cost, the economies of scale over many, many decades, that's now got to be applied to these new technologies to get them cheaper, to make them affordable. You know, we never would say that a vehicle is totally zero emission, But by and large, about 80% of the emissions of a vehicle come through its use, about 10 to 15% in its construction, 5 to 10% when you ultimately dispose of the vehicle. And that is equally another part of the equation that shouldn't be ignored. Battery electrics have certain advantages. You can recycle the batteries. Often they have a second life, which an internal combustion engine wouldn't. But in terms of the sourcing, the industry sign, you know, is looking at all its supply chains and has responsibility to do that. The two most common elements that go into batteries, lithium is readily available around the world. There's even some in Cornwall and the West Country. Cobalt is much rarer, tends to come from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And both the automotive industry and the battery are looking for alternatives, because not necessarily to say about how that is actually extracted, but because, you know, if you are dependent on one particular source and one particular chemical or material, that's an exposure in your supply chain. And you want to make sure that these are as sustainable as possible. So I think the industry, you know, it recognizes it's not just about focusing on the tailpipe. You've got to look at the complete life cycle of the vehicle. And to a certain extent, that's where battery does have a lot more compelling case than internal combustion engines.
Chris, some promote a zero emissions mandate that would make large automakers forced to sell certain numbers of zero EVs each year. I suppose this is something that could be done in the interim as emission-heavy vehicles are phased out. Can you tell us a bit about this and your perspective on it?
Our key concern is making sure that we have the right supply of vehicles, so the right number of vehicles supplied. There are many different ways to get to that. So rather than promote just one method of getting there, the key thing is to make sure that there are enough electric vehicles available to satisfy the demand that undoubtedly exists.
Mike, you've expressed concern that such a policy could constrict the market or make unfair outcomes.
It's potentially a very blunt instrument with unintended consequences. The industry has to deliver 100% pure electric or hybrids by 2030. And that's a massive shift in 9 years' time. If you try and force the market, you know, there's a danger that basically, you know, if you say a large, it'll be a percentage target, obviously, or based on market share. Given how competitive it is to try and get the supply of these vehicles into the UK, you may have to shrink the non-electric vehicle sales to meet your target. That puts up the price of both technologies, because you need to obviously make sure that it's still a competitive and a vibrant industry. So the danger is, it goes back to a question you asked earlier, is you're making it unaffordable for personal mobility, especially for those that would, you know, not yet be able to afford an electric vehicle given the price differential that's still there. There was actually a zero emission mandate in California in the early 2000s, which didn't really take effect. For the industry, it is about, we've got the goal. The market is going to decide, and the market is already voting with its wallets. 1 in 10 cars plug-in last year, likely to be something like 1 in 7 this year. You know, as Grant said, it's a massive increase. So I think, you know, let the market and the consumer demand. If we get the consumer support, which is what it's all about, it will deliver of itself.
Grant, the subsidies for consumers and for businesses for electric vehicles are very generous. Is this really the time to be spending all that cash? Surely a lot of these policies were brainstormed before we had a pandemic that sent the UK into the largest economic contraction that it's seen in 300 years. Is this still the priority?
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, look, first of all, sort of guilty as charged, we've got the biggest road building programme in history, £27 billion plus. We recognise that, you know, electric vehicles will need roads just as much as conventional vehicles have done. So, you know, yes, there's a lot of money going into road building, but I think that's a good thing. Just yesterday, I announced £500 million to fix potholes around the country. Again, I don't think you'll find many people objecting to that idea. In terms of money going into the vehicles, into the electric vehicles, just as we saw with the kind of progress of solar cells before, you start off with high subsidy and then, of course, it comes back down over the years. Actually, I think the grant, the plug-in car grant, which is currently at 3,000, but it's no secret it's coming down. And it's likely to come down quite quickly because the amount of money that we're spending on it, I had 582 million to spend on it in the latest budgetary period. And it's going very fast because, as Mike says, we're seeing this massive increase in the number of electric cars sold. So you can look out for that being reduced. But as we saw with solar before it, what happens, and actually wind power, back to my conversation with Chris from Centrica just before, what happens is, you know, it starts the market and then it grows on its own account. So I don't think it's desirable to have taxpayer dollars going straight from, you know, taxpayers paying the money, going straight into the pockets of people buying the cars. I think what you want to do is improve the infrastructure. And that is where we're likely to major. So there are two big, really big things. And first of all, we already have one of the biggest networks of public chargers in the country. There are something like 21,000 of them. There are more charging locations than petrol stations in the country now. 4,000 of them are rapid chargers. But those rapid chargers are the ones which really create the convenience. And whereas there are already chargers at every single motorway service station in the country, we want all of those to be rapid chargers. So we're going to put a lot of money into that. And that's about £1.3 billion to put that into perspective to support installation of charge points. Just last week, a couple of weeks ago, I announced £20 million, which is to get more chargers for people who need to charge on the road. About two-thirds of British households have somewhere to park their car where they could put in a charging point. That leaves a third who don't. We need to make sure that, you know, leaseholders and renters and everybody else has access, so there's money going into that sort of thing. And then finally, a lot of money going into the commitment to be able to scale up the production side of this. So, you know, there is a massive change that the manufacturers are going to need to make. I mean, we just saw that, for example, Jaguar Land Rover have announced that all of their models are going zero carbon, which is extremely welcome by the government. I think a real leadership position for them. But we want to make it easier for all the companies to do that. And so we're putting money into the transition, both the research, the battery side of things, actually money for new plants to produce electric batteries as well, and really to sort of, you know, hand in hand to help the sector make this transition from being a, you know, petrol, diesel to electric, and actually I hope also hydrogen industry in the next few years.
So I suppose to go full circle, Grant, that is a lot of money and isn't presented with having to make any real trade-offs. If it is the priority for all the very good reasons you lay out, perhaps scaling back projects like HS2 might find you the money to pay for it.
Well, I'm forever being tempted by people who tell me if you just take a tiny cut, usually very small, you know, percent or so of HS2 money, then you can do X, Y, Z. The HS2 train has left the station. We are building it. It's actually a year on now since we made the decision to build it. And there's physical work actually started. There are 10, 15,000 people employed directly, lots more indirectly in HS2. And I think it's perfectly conceivable to imagine a world whereby people both travel by train, probably for those longer journeys, but also travel by car. And I don't see there's any contradiction between the two. You know, the money going into electrification and zero-fication of our car network is not dependent on HS2. And just to put it into perspective, we've got about $1.3 billion in the next 3 years for the installation of new charge points. We've got $582 million that I was talking about for these plug-in car grants and incentives for people to make the switch. And we've got another £1 billion for the boosting investment into the manufacturing change that's required. So, yeah, we're putting a lot of money into it, but it's not dependent on cancelling HS2.
If I could come in after, I think the key thing here is about how do we get the infrastructure going? How do we create some momentum here? So in Centric, I mean, Grant mentioned about 21,000 public charge points. We've installed 17,000 charge points in the UK, from at-home charging right up to rapid 350 kilowatt chargers. It's really important that we continue to work with government, business, and for consumers to drive this, because you will get to a point whereby the adoption is so large, and as Mike said, the number of electric vehicles coming on this year, I think, outweighs the number of traditional vehicles. Once you get the momentum going, then I think this will take care of itself. So what we've done at Centrica, for example, is we committed to electrifying our fleet by 2030. But what I've been looking at this week with the team is we've got the third largest fleet in the UK. We've got 11,000 vehicles. And last year we placed an order for 1,000 electric vans from Vauxhall. So 50% of the total electric van sales in the UK. We placed another order for another 2,000 coming up. But the conversation I've been having with the team is we want to make everything absolutely perfect before we commit. Now, with a six-year fleet life, that means that we should be able to do it quicker than 2030. So the commitment we'll make is that we won't buy another internal combustion engine vehicle in Centrica. Our company's car scheme will now only do electric vehicles, and we will only buy electric vehicles. Now, the reason that, and I think other businesses need to think about this, the reason that we have not made that commitment is because we have a number of engineers. Our vans are taken home by the engineers, and we have a number of engineers who don't have access to a charge point. And so we know that if we give them an electric vehicle today, they don't have off-street parking, it's a problem. But actually, in 5 years' time, that will be solved if we all work together. So what we'll do for that engineer is if their van comes to the end of its life, we'll give someone else an electric vehicle and we'll take their internal combustion vehicle and give that to an engineer. So I think it's really important for businesses to walk the talk. And by bringing more scale, then we can create the momentum that's required to ultimately transform the transport in the UK.
Sorry, just to butt in if I may. I was just going to mention that we're talking about, 21,000 charge points and this, that, and the other. Actually, that figure's misleading because there are 150,000 charge points in people's homes, and those are just the ones the government or taxpayer has helped to fund through the grant for domestic charge points. So there'll be a lot more than 150,000 because not everyone has taken up the grant for various different reasons. So we can talk about hundreds of thousands of charging locations, millions in fact, because most of these cars you can actually plug in overnight or whatever to a 13 amp plug, although they're very slow to charge if you do. But the infrastructure is much more there than people would recognize when you hear about us talking about public charge points only. It makes it sound like we're at the beginning of this thing. In fact, we're several years into it already.
Chris, Grant has focused on the importance of infrastructure, but this means a lot of things. It's not just roads anymore. We're talking about smart charging, grids, how easy it's going to be to pay on the go. It takes on a whole new meaning of electric vehicles.
Indeed. So one of the things we've got to make sure is that when we think about infrastructure, we think about ultimately, how do we deliver the quantity of electricity to the right place at the right time to ensure that we can charge these electric vehicles? And we believe that we can do that without having to build a whole new grid or a whole new set of local grids. But you have to have smart management of your grids to do that. The solutions are software-based solutions. So for example, if you've got an at-home charger, ultimately where I think the future will go is that your car will become part of your integrated home energy management system. So at times of peak demand, when the grid has its peak demand, which is usually between 5 and 7 in the evening, your house might run off your car battery, but you still need your car charged in the morning if you're going to travel. And so you have to have smart systems. And where we see the future going, and we're developing technology for this, is you have smart systems whereby you plug your car in, you say what charge you want and by what time, and automatically our systems will either run your house off the car battery or will start to charge the car battery at points where the electricity is cheaper, where the demand on the grid is lower, stop when it's busy and more expensive, and restart when it's quieter and cheaper. That means we have to be able to bill electricity at far more frequent packets, probably every 30 minutes or so. And we have to have something that's integrated with the home system. We have that just now for an industrial scale customer. And what we're doing is to bring that down to size whereby you can use it for individual homes. That's the future that will enable full electric vehicle adoption in the UK.
Mike, I'd like your thoughts on the infrastructure, but Grant says that the infrastructure is really already there. Do you think the consumer demand is also there? According to a TRL poll, only a fourth of consumers are thinking about buying an EV car in the next 5 years.
Yeah, again, there's always polls, and we look at all of the surveys that are done by the motoring organisations and so forth. The two biggest obstacles to the take-up is affordability and infrastructure. So to a certain extent, you're going to have to, it's a perceived lack of infrastructure sometime. What Grant described, originally about, implicitly lives in a charging station is right, because the consumer wants that convenience. We know that most consumers will want to charge at home, and there are benefits potentially about feeding back into the grid and so forth. They'll be excellent. To do that, we need to obviously, for those that have a designated off-street parking, that's relatively straightforward. Manufacturers can help with that. But for those that don't, that's where the gap is, and it's that perceived gap. There is also issues around about, at the moment there are different networks and so forth. And I'm not looking to apportion blame, because I'd probably say the automotive industry didn't have its finest hour when it came up with three different plugs for different types of EVs. However, this is a new technology. There will be some, teething issues around it. So it is about having that convenience for the consumer. And in that regard, we need to overcome a perception that it's not there. So we may have to oversupply, particularly, as everyone is saying, on-street public charging. For those, I used to live in a terraced house, if you came home on a Saturday night after midnight, you could be parked half a mile away. You need to have the flexibility. It doesn't matter if I park half a mile, I know I can charge. Give people the peace of mind. The demand we're seeing already coming. I said 1 in 10 last year. It's probably going to be about 1 in 7 this year. The market is moving, but we need to make sure it's a mass market because we're still at the beginning of that transition.
It's a hell of a ramp up, though, actually, I was thinking, Mike, because when I got my car, it was 1 in 100. And that's when I was first Secretary of State. I'd had it on order for a couple of years. It's a great faith in the future. I sort of ordered the thing and hope that the manufacturer wouldn't go bust in the meantime. And I got the car and I remember it was 1 in 100. And now, after a year and a half, it's 1 in 10. I mean, I think there's a real exponential growth in these things. And so it's not very hard to project the line going forward, particularly now. You know, we've said that all cars will need to go zero carbon at the tailpipe. The non-existent tailpipe, in fact, because one of the things about these cars is they don't have an exhaust pipe.
Absolutely. And I think for the industry, it is about supply. And again, it's a competitive market, not just between the UK, other markets in Europe and globally. With any new technology, it tends to be in high demand because supply needs time to ramp up. And we need to address that. We need to make sure we're the most competitive place to allocate these vehicles. And that's where, you know, incentives and other issues come to the fore. But I think in terms of, you know, what you are seeing is, you know, people are prepared to wait for some of these cars because that shows where that demand is. You know, these are produced globally because the automotive industry is a global industry. And, you know, you have to sometimes wait for an allocation for the UK. We're a bit different. We demand the steering wheel is on the correct side of the car, not like everywhere else in the world. So all that affects production volumes. And it's, you know, for a manufacturer, it's about balancing allocation between different markets. Everyone, in terms of Western markets, is trying to move as quickly as possible down this road. If we can get ahead and get ahead with a strong UK manufacturing capability, then I think, you know, we are literally leading from the front.
Sorry, again, just a bus in here, but I've been tremendously impressed during my time as Secretary of State in two ways. One, by the sector itself. So if I think of my very earliest conversations with Mike from the motor vehicle manufacturing side of things, we were a long way off the kind of announcement we made last year about 2030. It would have, I think, been quite hard to imagine that we would have made that announcement, not only made it, but for it to be broadly welcomed by the industry. And then within a very short period of time to see industry leaders like JLR and others come along and say, yeah, we're doing this and we're going to do it even quicker than the 2030 that we've announced. So that's the first thing. I mean, I really pay tribute to the sector who've completely got behind this, understand it's the way the wind's blowing and have taken up a leadership role. And then secondly, to Centrica and companies like them, I think your first Vauxhall van, I think I came to launch it or see it I? You know, lovely bright blue van, be able to run around, not emitting carbon as it goes. And just since we've been recording this podcast, I just saw outside an Amazon van, quite a sizable machine actually turn up, and on the side it's got 100% electric on the side of it. So this is no longer just like a theoretical one or two kind of exemplar, you know, examples out there are brilliant. This is actually becoming mainstream. It's becoming day to day. And I think tribute to should be paid both to the industry, but also to the industries like the people who lease large numbers of cars, the Centricas of this world, the Amazon of this world, and others who lease large numbers of vehicles, because they're going to push the secondhand market here as well.
Chris, it certainly does feel like it's becoming more mainstream, but is it going to be accessible for everybody? EVs are still more expensive than traditional cars. You would expect that eventually, as more market players get involved, costs will come down for consumers. That's usually the course that takes place. But in the meantime, with this short time frame, are we at risk of putting the poorest in society effectively priced out of owning a car?
So I think that I would agree with Grant that the motor manufacturing industry is one of the most innovative that you'll find and will move very quickly. I think that the price curve will move a lot more quickly than we expect, and therefore I wouldn't expect to see people priced out of having a car. However, I do think it's really important to make sure that we have open public charging networks in order that the people that are less well off, that may not have off-street parking, have access, as Mike was saying, even if it's half a mile away from their home, they have access to charging points. And so it's really important that we don't have these proprietary systems that are built up. It would be anti-competitive. So in Centrica, what we want is to have public charging infrastructure. And then we're an energy supplier, so we have an interest in supplying the energy. But what we don't want to do is to say to somebody, you have to park beside a British Gas or Centrica charging point. You can park anywhere. And we've got some technology. So for example, 70% of the vans that we've got are charged at people's homes. We've developed some technology, and we're working now with a large leasing company. How do you manage that fleet? How do we make sure so our system will reimburse our engineers for their electricity costs without them having to submit a claim? Because we'll use the telematics in the van, which will then send something to an EV management system that we've put in place that will automatically pay engineers for the electricity that they use. There's a huge amount of technology that can be applied in how you manage your charging infrastructure, and it's really important that we make sure that it remains open source, for want of a better term. That's how you make sure that people are not priced out of having an electric vehicle.
Mike, do you think that the government has given the automotive industry and also consumers who would be purchasing a car in any price bracket enough time to prepare for the switch?
Well, we've got 9 years, which is very, very tough. If we're to succeed in that ambition, we do need to make sure that the consumer basically votes with their wallet. Now, of course, I would say that it's the industry. If you think about it, there's about 35 million cars on the road. And normally, not last year, probably not this year, but in a normal year, there's about 2.25, maybe 2.5 million new car sales. So you've got to change not just what people are buying today, but let that filter through the used car market and so forth. And that will take time. You know, it is a very, very good question to pose about the affordability, because at the moment, the majority of vehicles that are electric are in probably a medium to higher price bracket. We need to drive down that cost. That is about economies of scale. And that's why the industry is trying to ramp up production. But you've also got to look at the total cost of ownership. It's not just the sticker price. It is, what is it costing for your mobility? And that is a combination of how much it's costing to charge vis-a-vis how much it would cost you to refuel. What is the insurance costs? What are the other benefits that you can get in terms of reduced parking, in terms of maybe grant incentives and so forth? So it's a total cost of ownership. It's not quite at parity yet. The question is, when will it get to parity? It's probably going to be this decade, but it is also a function of global supply and demand. The sooner you can get these into the larger scale of volume production, it drives down the cost. This is an industry which is built on high volume, small margin. These vehicles at the moment tend to be loss leaders. So you want to minimize your loss. And the only way to do that is increase production.
I'd like to finish by asking you how you think the COVID crisis has potentially change the trajectory for electric vehicles. Grant, last year we saw carbon emissions fall spectacularly in lockdowns, but of course that's not a sustainable way to keep them low. Is a potential fear of the COVID crisis that you have more people reverting to cars for this mere sake of social distancing?
I think it is a genuine concern. And of course, no one can really safely predict exactly how we're going to come out of coronavirus and precisely what the position will be. For what it's worth, my big sort of macro guess at this is that although people think that, you know, the use of Zoom and the like mean that people will no longer travel as much, and perhaps feeling safer from coronavirus in the car will stop people from traveling on public transport, I suspect that both those predictions in the medium term are wrong. And the reason for that is that, you know, we've had, for example, Skype, invented in 2003, I think, and 18 years later, you know, it wasn't stopping us from making more car journeys, more train journeys, more flights than ever before. I suspect that in the end, the efficiency of video actually enables us to speed up the economy and actually create more reasons to travel in a bigger economy overall. I also think there'll be a lot of pent-up demand to travel. So I don't think there's a long-term issue with travel. People will always want to travel. My goodness, the one thing we've all learned is the kind of the lack of intimacy on a Zoom, spending all day on Zoom. So I think that people will want to go out and travel. Will they want to travel by car? Yeah, probably for a period of time. But there are always going to be limitations to cars. We need to get to zero carbon flight, which I can tell you makes getting to zero carbon driving look like a piece of cake. But we've got a Jet Zero Council set up with academics and academia and business and government working together to do the same thing with flights as been done with cars. And I think that ultimately people will still want to, if you're taking a longer journey, the kind of thing that HS2 will one day do, it's always going to be more convenient to get on a well-run, efficient train. So I think different forms of transport are still going to be in vogue. But yeah, the world's going to be a bit changed, and there's no point in saying otherwise. Quite how, and also how long that change lasts, is, of course, a factor of lots of things we don't know the answer to at the moment, like the way that the world will get back to normal after all these vaccines and presumably ongoing vaccines into the future.
Chris, the government is very insistent that the green agenda and its leveling up agenda and recovery from the COVID crisis are all going to come together as we bounce back from the economic catastrophe that has been COVID-19. Where do you think the opportunities are for EVs and where are the hurdles still?
I think one of the big opportunities is that we learn just how quickly we can adapt to unanticipated situations through COVID. And if you think about how quickly we went from everybody being in an office or a factory to everybody being at home, it was quite remarkable. So I think the biggest learning is just what we can do when we put our minds to it or when we have to. I do think that the green agenda and levelling up and coming out of the COVID crisis, I do think there's a lot of alignment there. It presents huge opportunity. It presents opportunity for us to deploy technology to meet the challenges that we've got, rather than to do what we've always done. So one of the questions is, how do we make sure we get enough electricity out there to charge these vehicles? The old-fashioned way is to build a new grid. The new way is to use the battery technology that we're driving for vehicles to have larger batteries and to have smarter grids. So we don't need a new grid to have every vehicle electric. We can cope with that just now, but we have to think differently. So I think the big thing that's come out of COVID is it teaches us just what we're capable of if we think a little bit differently. And I'm hopeful that we'll keep that as we go back to normal.
And Mike, of course, a crucial point of all of this is not leaving anybody behind. You mentioned that the industry is happy to have certainty around deadlines and targets now, but what more do they need?
It is reassurance. We will only achieve this goal if by taking the consumer, the customer with us. And that is about affordability. It is about the reassurance that they are, you know, it is a sensible and the right thing to do to invest in one of these vehicles. We've seen in the past how policy can affect the sale of particular types of technology. Think back to diesel. At the time, it was perceived that was the right thing to do because diesel tends to have much lower carbon emissions than petrol. There are other sides in terms of air quality, which it wasn't as good. And so hence, there is a skepticism there about any technological shift. The other analogy is, you know, you think back to the first, I'm old enough to remember this, the first video recorders where you had Betamax and VHS. There isn't that dichotomy now. Yes, there are different types of electrification in terms of battery, in terms of plug-ins, which can suit different types of driving needs. But essentially, this is about the electrification of the vehicle, moving away from the internal combustion engine to the electrification. So it is about informing the customers, and that's where government can help. And we've been working with them on a number of years in terms of, you know, addressing some of those consumer perceptions, misconceptions sometimes, but also about the industry making it an easy route to purchase. So people understand what the costs are, what is required, because it is a bit different, a slightly different mindset. But, you know, in terms of where we are at the moment with COVID, people are at home. We are seeing huge amounts of people going online and sort of not necessarily purchasing online, but although click and collect seems to be working to a certain extent, but finding out more information. So the more that you can provide and reassure customers that this is the future, the entire global industry is going in this direction. So, you know, it's not a bad or a risky decision. It's the right decision.
I just wanted to actually add one point. I keep meaning to say in response to Chris's point, which is I do agree with him about the necessity for it to be really easy and convenient. Mike's referred to the same thing, to be able to, you know, just charge up the car. And one of the things you find as an electric car driver at the moment is that you rock up at whatever the terminal is, the charging station is, and once you've fought through which proprietary plug to use, and you've always got converters, so you can always use them, but that's one issue. You then have to work out which membership card you're supposed to be carrying and have already signed up to and have attached your credit card or a PayPal to or something like that. The whole thing is far too complicated. We've already taken the power to ensure that all of these stations simply accept contactless payment. So you wave your credit card or wave your phone and you're done. And we are working with the electric charging industry, which is quite disparate at the moment. There are a lot of firms involved in it, to have them all offer, particularly on the rapid charging, contactless payment and no need to kind of subscribe in advance. I've got those powers and I'm maneuvering them to, I hope, voluntarily do it. And if not, we'll use the Act in Parliament to force the situation. For this to work, it has to be truly convenient for everybody. And that just means being able to rock up, touch the for payment contactlessly and go.
Absolutely. And ultimately, where we think it can get to is that if you're a customer, for example, of British Gas, you can turn up and just plug it in and it knows you're a British Gas customer, it just goes onto your bill. That's ultimately where we think we can get the technology to. That's what we've developed for our van fleet and using the telematics in the van very practically so.
Mike, Chris, Grant, thanks so much for joining me.